Now, the whole world has been made to wait with bated breath while the news media beats the drum, building the mass hysteria that buttons were going to be punched at 12:01, 9 o'clock West Coast time, 12:01 United Nations time, on this day, doing the countdown, building the drama, doing their best to try to pierce security as a traitor. Beginning with Nightline last night, I could not believe my ears, knowing how low the media is and how elevated they are in their opinion of themselves, that somehow or other they're God above the conflict. To see Ted Koppel try to pierce what is obviously classified information, whether or not the Israelis and the U.S. will try to coordinate in case Israel is attacked to avoid possible conflicts of identity between Israeli planes and American planes. A 10-year-old in the United States that doesn't know that should be committed. I mean, don't you know the answer to that? So what purpose was served with Koppel's megalomaniac probing? One, you know, once in a while, is like keeping score to see if you can reach 10 in a year. Andy Rooney came off with a pretty good one the other night, positive. 1,000 traitorous shots, and then you get one good thing. One network. I only saw it once, like maybe somebody disciplined them for telling the truth. One network pointed out of the so-called 4,000 Iraqi tanks, less than 500 can operate. But every other network says we're going up against 4-1. That same network tallied of the so-called 400,000 to 500,000 troops, less than 150 can be deemed capable of putting up a fight, trained and able to function. Their Air Force, with a vaunted number of planes, was reduced down to 150 that posed any kind of challenge of modern vintage at all. And the only thing they gave them any credence for was artillery. Well, big deal, a couple of battleships can match them with 16-inch guns. Again, a 10-year-old. A lot of us were under the impression that the kickoff time was 12:01 midnight Iraqi time. When it was clarified that the time was 12:01 New York time, any 10-year-old could figure out that the attack is going to be launched at night, not the daytime, if the United States wants to take advantage of its night-seeing superiority. So the real threat during this day, when the deadline was reached, was Saddam. And if he's smart and wants to take that advantage away, he would do a peremptory strike to force the war to start during the daylight hours. But anybody should have been able to figure out that the attack wouldn't come at exactly 12:01 New York time, in the middle of the morning with the sun coming up. I mean, these are not German, I mean, Japanese kamikazes who worship the rising sun. So the media's been at it again. Not too many anchors in Saudi Arabia either, you notice? Now, I want to do a little bit of background and in-depth reporting on Saddam himself and the way he came to power and this evil man that we are poised to go to war with, but I want to know that you're there. I assume that everybody would fall for the bait of the news media, probably underestimated you, as I do sometimes, and you'd be listening for the first hour just to see, now that you're bored seeing yesterday's newsreel footage reported on the brink today, seeing the same guy waving a submachine gun in the air that we saw yesterday, as though it's happening today in Jordan, and an hour or so past the so-called deadline, you might be returning back here to listen and be taught. Now, you know that those who take the trouble to research it out find that the last reference in Scripture and the Apocrypha that was part of the King James and every translation back to the Septuagint, the one that Jesus used, the northern tribes, the house of Israel, when offered to return to Palestine, refused. Took counsel among themselves and determined that they would find a country where they could worship their gods and do their thing their own way. They therefore, because there was such a multitude, it took them a year and a half with much tumult to pass through the headwaters of the Euphrates River and disappear from biblical history. You follow that route, they end up north of the Black Sea. At exactly the time in history that they disappear, and in exactly the place north of the Black Sea, the Celts appear mysteriously. Tribal groups practicing primogeniture in successive waves, forming the nations of northern and Western Europe. You know that in Genesis, when Jacob passed on the birthright, he gave the birthright to the sons of Joseph, headed by Ephraim, whose name became synonymous with the northern kingdom, the house of Israel, as Judah's name became synonymous with the southern kingdom. To Joseph, through Ephraim, went the birthright, the promise of a nation of great multitude, possessing the gates of their enemies, never defeated in battle, pushing nations to the end of the globe, multiplied kings existing at the same time. To Judah went the scepter, the right to be king, which included the righteous seed, the King of Kings, and the right to make the laws. Now in Ezekiel 37, after the valley of dry bones, symbolic of the resurrection to life of God's people, Ezekiel is speaking, and this is just in front of Ezekiel 38, known as the beginning of the Russia chapters, 38 and 39 of Ezekiel. 37th chapter comes right in front of it. The word of the Lord came again unto me, saying, "Moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah, and for the children of Israel his companions, because some of the house of Israel went south to the kingdom of Judah and attached themselves because the temple was there, and some were always associated with Judah as companions. For Judah, take one stick and write upon it for Judah, and for the children of Israel his companions. Then take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions. Join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thine hand. And when the children of thy people shall speak unto thee, saying, 'Wilt thou not show us what thou meanest by these?' say unto them, 'Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his fellows,'" notice tribes of Israel, his fellows, "and will put them with him, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in mine hand, and the sticks whereon thou writest shall be in thine hand before their eyes." Now, isn't that interesting? Here we have Judah returned to Israel, and the leading Celtic nations, the house of Israel, positioned on the other side of the desert, aimed toward Babylon, the ancient, and aimed toward Nineveh, the ancient two enemies of Israel and Judah. And if war takes place, even the Saudi Arabs will wait behind. The British, Ephraim and Manasseh, U.S., the house of Joseph and the house of Judah will be one attacking this ancient enemy of God's people. I find that interesting. The former liberal creatively turned neo-orthodox, Reinhold Niebuhr, in 1949, about the close of the Second World War, wrote in his little book, Faith and History, "At their worst, sectarian Christianity, liberal Christianity, which he used to be a part of, and modern secular liberalism have all become united in the errors and sentimentalities of a soft utopianism which manages to evade the tragic realities of life and to obscure the moral ambiguity in all political positions. The recent encounter of the democratic world with tyrannical forces might have proved fatal to civilization had not the common sense of the children of this world outweighed the illusions of the children of light. For the soft utopians were prepared to meet malignant evil with non-resistance, hoping that kindness would convert the hearts of tyrants. I think I ought to read that again, slow and with a little more mic. Whoever's upstairs. At their worst, Reinhold Niebuhr speaking, 1949. I did my doctoral dissertation on Reinhold Niebuhr, second only to the Apostle Paul. He helped shape my practical thinking. In companionship with a hard thought out faith. At their worst, sectarian Christianity, liberal Christianity, and modern secular liberalism have all become united in the errors and sentimentalities of a soft utopianism, which manages to evade the tragic realities of life and to obscure, that's the line that's important, to obscure the moral ambiguity of all political positions, including the ones they're taking. These evasions are achieved by hoping for a progressive alteration of the character of human history. And it won't happen. The answer to history will come from beyond history, when Christ breaks through and with a sword out of his mouth removes the tyrant of all tyrants. Not with soft-spoken words or waiting. The recent encounter, this was written in 1949, the recent encounter of the democratic world with tyrannical forces might have proved fatal to civilization had not the common sense of children of this world outweighed the illusions of the children of light. I am sick to death at the free coverage the media now is giving preachers who are singing a song the media likes. All I got to say is the spirit of Antichrist is at work in Baghdad, from one of the places most likely to produce the real Antichrist at the end of time. And the spirit of the false prophet is at work in this land, saying, bow down in order to get on peaceably. The book of Revelation describes such preachers as looking like a lamb. They have all the trappings of Jesus, but they get their message from the dragon, which says, bow down to Antichrist. Thought I'd show you how timely Ron Lieber still is. Here's a little book, Saddam Hussein and the Crises in the Gulf, by Judith Miller and Lori Milroy. Now, Saddam Hussein came to power as a member of the Ba'ath Party, or Ba'ath Party, as we would say it. Started out with less than 100. Came to power with about 1,000. He was in charge of internal security. And a thug of the thugs. But more importantly, the February 1963, that's how recent, coup. The February 1963 coup against Qasim, their predecessor, ruler of Iraq, marked the arrival of a new and ruthless player in Iraqi politics, the Ba'ath Party of Ahmad Hassan al-Bakr and later Saddam Hussein. The Ba'ath, or Ba'ath, Arabic for Renaissance, began as a political movement in Syria. Listen to the time, in the 1930s. It soon came to be dominated by two Damascus high school teachers, Michelle Aflaq and Salah Bitar, who had studied together at the Sorbonne between 1928 and 1932. Aflaq was the party's leading ideologue or philosophic thinker, and he would remain closely associated with the Iraqi regime until his death in 1989. He is buried in the Ba'ath National Party headquarters in Baghdad. As a student in Paris, I'm tired of the hypocrisy of the media. And their constant hammering on a subject they should hammer on. May this world never again tolerate anywhere on this globe the makings of a Holocaust. What Nazi Germany did with its demented from the pit of hell ideology to the Jew. And the media has been beating in our ears quite properly. My problem is that nothing takes root in them. Theirs is the argument of hypocrisy and convenience. If it were as deep as skin, they would be consistent. And we have watched over the decades since television took shape, nothing brings their ire. And quite rightly, when you understand the Jewish population group that's involved in the media and in their legal teams that represent them, they have quite properly, maybe the finest thing the media has done is to educate the public on the horrors of the Holocaust, the evils that let it happen, and a spirited attempt to make sure that the world stays on alert to never let it happen again. Why then are they neglecting to tell us what I'm about to tell us? If theirs is a genuine, conscience-level, ideological commitment to a proper horror of the things that allowed Hitler to come to power and made the task so difficult to overthrow him. And by the way, Germany wasn't much bigger than Iraq. All Germany did was be let alone long enough to develop superior weapons. Aflaq was the party's leading ideologue. As a student in Paris, Aflaq was attracted to the fascist ideas then fashionable in Europe. He was full of enthusiasm for Hitler, and other German fascists, according to the Syrian-born historian Bassam Tabi. Like Hitler, a flock was a Christian. And by the way, the Catholic Church has yet to excommunicate Hitler. And it was the soft utopian clergyman singing peace at any cost who could have stopped Hitler and didn't. Instead, they resisted any effort to put the tyrant down through force. The flock saw in Nazi Germany a model for his ideas of a synthesis between nationalism and socialism. At the time of the 1941 coup, the pro-German Rashid Ali, he and Bitar formed a society to help Iraq, the nucleus of what later became that country's Ba'ath Party, according to the Princeton historian Bernard Lewis. Aflaq's view of Arab nationalism was quite romantic, far more radical than that of the liberal nationalist. Aflaq exalted the glory of the Arabs as a race, as expressed in the Ba'athist slogan, "One Arab Nation with an Eternal Mission." Now, those that have been singing songs, and quite rightly, legitimately, properly, commendably, arguing against racism in this country, seeking to cure the evils and making great progress to remove the barriers to civil equality, now would complain, even though it's not demonstrated as true, but if true, as some statistical imbalance of minority groups in the army that's fighting a racism comparable only to the Aryan superiority of race view of Hitler Germany. I want the blacks and the Latinos to understand, and the whites, to the Ba'ath Party, fostered in this Hitler-worshipping, articulator and founder of the principles and ideology of Saddam's party, has the same view of the Arabs that Hitler had of the Aryans. That means gas us all. Now, it seems to me somewhat hypocritical to see the united effort of the very same people marching in the streets today against war in Iraq. These very same people, quite rightly, don't anybody misunderstand, I'm on their side in their march against South Africa. I once spent a long time tracing from Cecil Rhodes and the Dutch Reformed Church the roots of the mentality of South Africa. And took the view that sanctions would only produce more bloodshed at the particular time. at a better time. Sanctions begin to work. And though he's not moving fast enough for the extremists, the present Prime Minister of South Africa will probably go down in history as the man who began the turn of the tide. And he will be lucky if he lives out his days without a white supremacy radical assassinating him in South Africa. And the United Media and the United World attack on the racial savagery of South Africa was right. Where are those same voices against Iraq? It's the media that educated the world on the racism of South Africa. It's the media that's educated the world continually with the memory and made every modern German have a knee-jerk defensive posture going out the gate. Never forget the Holocaust. Where's that same media? Where are those same marchers in the streets? Where are those same people who had no problem at all with force as a necessary means of getting South Africa's attention and in supporting the African National Congress and all of its justifications from Mandela down? When all else fails, you use force. And I'm with Mandela on that point. What I'm complaining about is the inconsistency when the target is fascistic, Hitler-spawned Saddam Hussein and his ruling Ba'ath Party. Some of you are hearing this for the first time. How many knew that their ideologue worshipped Hitler and began forming his thoughts in Europe with the rise of Hitler and Mussolini? How many knew that before tonight? Not one person in this room. Two, three people in this room. Am I boring you? Saddam Hussein loves The Godfather. It's his favorite movie. One he has seen many times. He's especially fascinated by Don Corleone, a poor boy made good whose respect for family is exceeded only by his passion for power. The iron-willed character of the Don may perhaps be the most telling model for the enigmatic figure that rules Iraq. Both come from dirt poor peasant villages. Both sustain their authority by violence. And for both, family is key, the key to power. Family's everything, or almost everything. Because Saddam, like the Godfather, ultimately trusts no one, not even his next of kin. For both, calculation and discipline, loyalty and ruthlessness are the measure of a man's character. Both the Don and Saddam relish power and seek respect, the more so because each knows what it means to have none. Neither ever forgot an insult, however trivial or imagined, both secure in the knowledge that, as Mario Puzo observed of his fictional character, quote, "In this world there comes a time when the most humble of men if he keeps his eyes open, can take his revenge on the most powerful. End quote. And in this likeness, there perhaps lies the key to understanding Saddam Hussein's ambition. Saddam, the name means one who confronts. And they expected him to blink. Saddam Hussein was born 53 years ago, at the time of this book's writing. April 28, 1937, to a miserably poor landless peasant family in the village of Al-Auja, near the town of Takrit, on the Tigris River, 100 miles north of Baghdad. Although Muslims do not generally share the Western custom of celebrating birthdays, Saddam has made his a national holiday in Iraq. The Arab town of Takrit lies in the heart of the Sunni Muslim part of Iraq. But in Iraq, the Sunnis are a minority. More than half the country is Shiite, the Sunni's historical and theological rivals. Takrit had prospered in the 19th century, renowned for the manufacture of kalaks, round rafts made of inflated animal skins. But as the raft industry declined, so did the fortunes of the town. By the time Saddam was born, it had little to offer its inhabitants. Communication with the outside world was difficult. While the Baghdad-Mosul Railway ran through Takrit, the town had but one paved road. Saddam's nearby village was even worse off. It had only dirt roads. Its people, including Saddam and his family, lived in huts made of mud and reeds and burned cow dung for fuel. No one, either in Takrit or in Al-Auja, had electricity or running water. The central government in Baghdad seemed far away, its authority limited to the presence of some local policemen. Accounts of Saddam's early years are murky. The unsavory aspects of Saddam's harsh and brutal childhood are not something he once knew. It is usually said that Saddam's father, Hussein al-Majid, died either before Saddam's birth or when he was a few months old, but a private secretary of Saddam's, who later broke with him, has suggested that Saddam's father abandoned his wife and young children. Whatever the truth, after her husband was gone, Saddam's mother, Suba, was on her own until she met Ibrahim Hassan, a married man. Eventually, she convinced him to get rid of his wife and to marry her instead. By Muslim law, Ibrahim was permitted four wives, but Suba insisted on being the only one. Saddam's stepfather was a crude and illiterate peasant who disliked his stepson, treated him abusively. Years later, Saddam would bitterly recall how his stepfather would drag him out of bed at dawn, barking, "Get up, you son of a whore, and look after the sheep." You want me to continue?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
You know, I never really thought that I would see in this country children being exploited in marches on issues they obviously cannot speak with balanced, learned opinions about, and the media featuring them, the way children are organized in Iraq and Iran to march for causes. And those that are organized against the war just thought of it first. I mean, what high school kid wouldn't skip class to march for anything? The ones that are organized for peace just got the jump on the other side, as if these kids marching have something intelligent to say about the issues of life. And yet the media will feature them as an authority on the subject of war or peace. Tell me a war in the history of mankind. Tell me if the Civil War, white plantation children could have been made to march in the streets for either side, and white industrial city children could have been made to march in the streets in the north for any side. I was playing basketball in elementary school when we were made to stand at attention and listen to Roosevelt's speech after Pearl Harbor. I was really an expert and a candidate to march in the streets on the subject of war. I mean, I want you to see what the media is cramming down our throat and their unwillingness to let any issue be settled. Congress has voted. Doesn't matter whether it's a small or a large majority. That's the way the system works. Tell me how big a majority has elected any president in America. Every president that we've had in this nation was elected with a smaller majority than that which went through the houses of Congress. But this system rallies behind the vote when it's made. The system had its chance. The vote was cast. But the media doesn't believe in the system. They use the system. And when it doesn't come up with the conclusion they want, they keep the issue going on another front. They are the sorest, sorriest, poorest losers ever pandered off on mankind. Saddam's stepfather was crude, illiterate, peasant who disliked his stepson, and treated him abusively. Years later, Saddam would bitterly recall how his stepfather would drag him out of bed at dawn, barking, "Get up, you son of a whore, and look after the sheep." Ibrahim often fought with Subah, the mother of Saddam, complaining, "He's a son of a dog, I don't want him." Still, Ibrahim found some use for the boy, often sent Saddam to steal chickens and sheep, which he then resold. When Saddam's cousin, Adnan Khairallah, who would become Iraq's defense minister, started to go to school, Saddam wanted to do the same, but Ibrahim saw no need to educate the boy. He wanted Saddam to stay home and take care of the sheep. Saddam finally won out. In 1947, at the age of 10, he began school. He went to live with Adnan's father, Khairallah Tulfa, his mother's brother, a schoolteacher in Baghdad. Several years before, Khairallah had been cashiered from the Iraqi army for supporting this is his uncle that he goes to live with, for supporting a pro-Nazi coup in 1941, which the British suppressed, instilling in Khairallah a deep and lasting hatred for Britain and for imperialism. Whether Saddam's stepfather kicked him out of the house or whether he left at his own initiative for his uncle's home in Baghdad is unclear. What is certain is that Khairallah Tulfa, who would later become mayor of Baghdad, would come to wield considerable influence over Saddam, a supporter of a pro-Nazi coup. Having started elementary school when he went to live with Khairallah, Saddam was 16 when he finished intermediary school, roughly the equivalent of an American junior high school. Like his uncle, he wanted to become an army officer, but his poor grades kept him out of the prestigious Baghdad Military Academy. Of the generations of Arab leaders who took power in the military coups of the 50s and 60s, only Saddam Hussein had no army experience. spite of his strutting uniform. Though his official biography notes his love of guns starting at age 10, in 1976 he would correct the deficiency by getting himself appointed lieutenant general, a rank equal to the chief of staff. And when Saddam became president in 1979, he would promote himself to field marshal and would insist on personally directing the war against Iran. He did real good, too. Got most of the Iraqis killed. Baghdad was utterly different from the world he had left behind in his small village. And times were unusually turbulent when Saddam was a student in Baghdad. Saddam found himself swept up in a world of political intrigue. In 1956, Saddam participated in an abortive coup against the Baghdad monarchy. The next year, at the age of 20, he joined the Ba'ath Party, one of several radical nationalist organizations, pro-Nazi, its ideologue, as I've said, studying at the Sorbonne, a hero worshiper of both Hitler and Mussolini, promoting an Arab superiority, a racism, only analogous to the Aryan views of Hitler. Only the race had changed. And it doesn't matter that Iran's Muslim, they're Persians. They're not Arabs. They're racists. And how come the media not once has rung a note about the racist basis for Saddam and Iraq's activities? But the Ba'ath in Iraq were a tiny and relatively powerless band of about 300 in those days. In 1958, a non-Ba'athist group of nationalist army officers led by General Abdul Karim Qasim succeeded in overthrowing King Faisal II, Faisal. Now, you'll remember his father, Faisal, made famous in Lawrence of Arabia. The fall of the monarchy intensified plotting among Iraq's rival dissident factions. A year after Qasim's coup, the Ba'ath tried to seize power by machine gunning Qasim's car in broad daylight. Saddam was a member of the hit team. He had already proven his mettle, or in the jargon of the American underworld, had made his bones by murdering a communist supporter of Qasim in Tikrit. The communists were the Ba'ath's fierce rivals. Interesting fact, the man Saddam killed was his brother-in-law. There had been a dispute in the family over politics, and his uncle, Khairallah, had incited Saddam to murder him. Although Saddam and Khairallah were arrested, they were soon released. In the anarchic confusion of Baghdad after the monarchy's fall, political crimes were common and often unpunished. Now, Iraqi propaganda now, under Saddam's control, embellishes his role in the attempt on Qasim's life, portraying him as a bold and heroic figure. He is said to have been seriously wounded in the attack, bleeding profusely. He orders a comrade to dig a bullet out of his leg with a razor blade, an operation so painful it causes him to faint. He then disguises himself as a Bedouin tribesman, swims across the Tigris River, steals a donkey, and flees to safety across the desert to Syria. And most of Iraq believes that hogwash propaganda machine story today. The truth is less glamorous. Iraqi sources present at the time insist that Saddam's role in the failed assassination attempt was minor. He was only lightly wounded. The wound was inadvertently inflicted by his own comrades. A sympathetic doctor treated Saddam and several others much more seriously hurt at a party safe house. Saddam would later have the opportunity to reward him for his help When the Ba'ath Party finally succeeded in taking power in 1968, the doctor was made dean of the Medical College of Baghdad University, a post he held until he broke with Saddam in 1979. Small price to pay to support the false story. From Syria, Saddam went to Cairo, where he would spend the next 4 years. The stay in Egypt was to be his only extended experience in another country. Supported by an Egyptian government stipend, he resumed his political activities, finally finishing high school at the age of 24. In Cairo, he was arrested twice and both times quickly released. The first arrest occurred after he threatened to kill a fellow Iraqi over political differences. He was arrested again when he chased a fellow Ba'ath student through the streets of Cairo with a knife. The student was later to serve as Jordan's information minister. Saddam entered Cairo's University's Faculty of Law in 1961. He eventually received his law degree, not in Cairo, but in Baghdad in 1970 after he became the number two man in the regime. It was an honorary degree. While in Cairo, Saddam married his uncle Khairallah's daughter, Sahida, in 1963. His cousin. His studies in Egypt ended abruptly in February when Ba'athist army officers and a group of Arab nationalist officers together succeeded in ousting and killing General Qasim, a figure of considerable popularity, particularly among the poor of Iraq. Of Qasim, Hanna Batutatu, the author of an authoritative history of Iraq, has written, the people had more genuine affection for him than any other ruler in the modern history of Iraq. Many people refused to believe that Qasim was dead. It was rumored that he had gone into hiding and would soon surface. Saddam's party, the Ba'athists, found a macabre way to demonstrate Qasim's mortality. They displayed his bullet-ridden body on television night after night. As Samir al-Khalil, in his excellent book, Republic of Fear, which is a horror story of Saddam's activities, tells it, quote, the body was propped upon a chair in the studio. A soldier sauntered around handling its parts. The camera would cut to scenes of devastation at the Ministry of Defense where Qasim had made his last stand. There on location, it lingered on the mutilated corpses of Qasim's entourage. Back to the studio and close-ups now of the entry and exit points of each bullet hole in his body. The whole macabre sequence closes with a scene that must forever remain etched on the memory of all those who saw it. The soldier grabbed the lolling head by the hair, came right up close, and spat full face into it. Saddam was elated. He hurried back to Baghdad to assume his part in the revolution. He was 26 years old. Saddam quickly found his place in the new regime. He became an interrogator and torturer in the so-called Palace of the End, where King Faisal and his family were gunned down in 1958. Under the Ba'ath, Saddam's party, the palace was used as a torture chamber. Few in the West are aware of Saddam's activities there, but an Iraqi arrested and accused of plotting against the Ba'ath has told of his own torture at the palace by Saddam himself. My arms and legs were bound by rope. I was hung on the rope to a hook on the ceiling. I was repeatedly beaten with rubber hoses filled with stones. He managed to survive his ordeal. Others were not so lucky. When the Ba'ath, riven by internal splits, was ousted 9 months later in November 1963 by the army, a grisly discovery was made in the place Saddam Hussein was in charge. In the cellars of the Al-Nahya Palace, according to Hanna Batatu, whose account is based on official government sources, quote, were found all sorts of loathsome instruments of torture, including electric wires with pincers, pointed iron stakes on which prisoners were made to sit, and a machine which still bore traces of chopped-off fingers. Small heaps of blooded clothing were scattered about, and there were pools on the floor and stains over the walls. During the party split in 1963, Saddam had supported Michel Aflaq, the Hitler-worshipping ideologue of the party, French-educated Syrian, the party's leading ideologue and co-founder of the party. Saddam was rewarded the next year when Aflaq sponsored him for the position in the Ba'ath Regional Command, the party's highest decision-making body in Iraq, and with this appointment, Saddam began his rapid ascent within the party. And the torturing and thuggery will continue ad infinitum. He is characterized as participating himself in many executions, taking his associates out while he pulls the pistol and does the job. We have a madman, a fool like Hitler, who still in his bunker believed that Nazi Germany was going to win. And we got 10-year-olds running around the streets saying no blood for oil. This is a moral issue. Where's the media on this subject? I mean, novels are written of the Nazi children, the boys from Brazil of the Nazi children, the Fourth Reich reemerging, and the whole world must be on its alert to spot an emerging Hitler. Hell, you need a barn door to hit you in the face to know it's there? Where's the hypocritical media? Supposed to be on guard, protecting the people's right to know. If the army's there for oil, we could be so lucky. Now we can tell them why they're really there. Germany in particular held a powerful attraction to the Iraqis as their nation was taking shape. Sunni Arab nationalists, including the military officers, came to see Iraq as the Prussia of the Arab world. The dream was that Iraq, by virtue of its early independence and through its army, would unite the Arabs. The Nazis actively cultivated the Iraqis, and Hitler's success in defying Britain and France further enhanced the pro-German sentiments of the young urban elite and the army officers of Iraq. But there was more to fascism's appeal than simple revenge against the British. Militarism emerged in Germany and Japan as a consequence of a rigid conservative social order undergoing the stress of rapid modernization. The same factors were at work in Iraq. It was a sign of the times in 1938 when an ardent Arab nationalist, Sami Shaukat, was appointed Director General of Education, shaping the minds of the young in Iraq. Shaukat was a fascist who admired Mussolini. If we do not want death under the hooves of the horses and the boots of the foreign armies, it is our duty to perfect the manufacture of death, the profession of the army, the sacred military profession, he had once proclaimed. But the soft utopian clergy, the false prophets who look like Christ and speak with the voice of the dragon, get their message from him. and the media that must be clones of Chamberlain. Whose genetic roots must somehow be found in Munich, would have us wait. Go on telephone. Marina Del Rey points out that the media, in their endless parade of good terrorist targets, just in case Saddam can't figure them out, never once suggested television stations. Notice that? By the way, for what should be obvious reasons, we're increasing our security. So some of you that don't mind walking a beat and put in applications before, we're going to hire 4 or 5 more this week. So now's your chance in this recession when everybody seems to be out of work. We're going to hire some. Anaheim, Doc, I'm a student of ancient history and I watch you all the time. You are so right. The whole nation needs to hear what you're saying tonight. Well, I'll get some more to say. We are supposed to be terrorized, as Andy Rooney said. We've spent $4 trillion for 40 years preparing to fight a nation of 300 million with nuclear capacity. And we're supposed to be terrorized with Iraq. Well, reading from Saddam Hussein, The Crisis in the Gulf, by Judith Miller and Lori Milroy. We'll try to have some of these in the bookstore Sunday, so don't go running out to empty the stores. It was all over in less than a minute. At dusk on Sunday, June 7th, 1981, we have 400. And Israel has another 192 above these 8. At dusk on Sunday, June 7, 1981, 8 Israeli F-16 jet fighters and 6 F-15 fighter interceptors zoomed out of the setting sun and obliterated Iraq's most prized possession. Listen to this. The French-built nuclear reactor, Osiris, named after Osiris, the Egyptian god of the dead. Although the nuclear facility on the outskirts of Baghdad was protected with French-made Roland ground-to-air missiles, the Iraqi soldiers on the ground never fired them. The only resistance came from a small battery of anti-aircraft guns, which sprayed the air haplessly with fire as the fighters dived down on their target again and again. The planes covered the nuclear reactor's sandy brown concrete dome with bombs bearing delayed action fuses, designed to explode when they hit the base of the dome, so that the reactor core buried deep in the ground would be destroyed in less than a minute. Osiris was history, and so was the raid. It's gone like a Swiss watch, a relieved Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin was told. According to Steve Weissman and Herbert Krosny's dramatic account of the mission, better than a Swiss watch. The announcement from the Prime Minister's office on the afternoon of the attack was more subdued. Quote, on Sunday, June 7th, 1981, the Israel Air Force launched a raid on the atomic reactor Osiris near Baghdad. Our pilots carried out their mission fully. The reactor was destroyed. All our aircraft returned safely to base, end quote. The attack, of course, was to have profound diplomatic and political consequences. The United States would spend the next months working with Iraq on various United Nations resolutions condemning Israel. Even more vehement was France, which deplored the attack and the killing of a French engineer at the site. But France's outrage was in part theatrics. According to an authoritative source, Israel had told the newly elected and friendly socialist government of President François Mitterrand that it intended to stage such an attack, and President Mitterrand, the only foreign leader to be informed before the raid, had not objected. Most governments profess shock and disapproval, but among many of their nuclear experts, there was a sense of relief. The French had supplied technology that was far too sophisticated for Iraq's nuclear energy program. Baghdad's steady stream of acquisitions in the late 1970s, some of which could only be explained if Iraq was planning to build a bomb, had raised concern in capitals throughout the West. Although Iraq, unlike Israel, did not have a weapon and was a signatory in good standing to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, most nuclear experts eventually concluded, as did Leonard S. Spector, a respected analyst in Washington, that, quote, the hidden objective behind Iraq's expansion of its nuclear sector in the mid-1970s was the gradual acquisition of a nuclear weapons capability. Iraq, of course, was humiliated by the Israeli attack. The ground-to-air missiles had been installed specifically to prevent an attack on the precious reactor. In September 1980, 8 days after Iraq invaded Iran, another reactor had been damaged in an air attack, this time with the Iranians, not the Israelis. As deputy president in 1976, Saddam Hussein had personally negotiated the purchase of the French reactor during a visit to Paris, a rare foray to the West for him. According to Weizmann and Krosny, Saddam had told a Beirut newspaper in 1975 that his hunt for a supposedly peaceful reactor was part of, quote, the first Arab attempt at nuclear arming. After the Israeli raid, his visions of an Iraqi bomb were as shattered as the blocks and shards of concrete that littered the Osirak site. In less than a minute, it was over. Israel, who's met him, is willing to absorb the first blow. And they know that if this little band of F-16s and F-15s could do that, their entire Air Force, without our help, could obliterate Iraq. Yet the media would scare us to death. Admittedly, a ground war is serious, whatever the numbers. But we have the capacity to turn Iraq into a wasteland. But a week from now, the soft utopia Christians will be holding candle wakes for the innocent dead in Iraqi. They're the ones that let this butcher come to power. Got to fix responsibility somewhere. If I have more time tonight, I'll show you why he rules totally. The only difference between Iraq and Germany and Hitler and Saddam, both deified the state. Both promote a racist superiority view, Saddam has been more successful than Hitler in moving the next stage, where he is above the state and they worship him. And left alone, he will have nuclear capacity. And pray tell me, what logic is there in moving 450,000 troops and all the armament we have in place there back home so we can go back 10 years from now and fight him when he has nuclear capacity? Heroes are made because you're in the place at the time it's called for. And it is a time for heroism, for the sake of mankind and for the war between good and evil. Bucker, who became Secretary General of the Ba'ath Party in 1963, deputized Saddam to organize the civilian branch of the party and to set up the party's internal secret police. Under Bucker's patronage, Saddam began to emerge as a power within the newly invigorated Ba'ath Party. 2 years later, on July 17, 1968, the Ba'ath succeeded in seizing state power for the second time in 5 years. They made their move in coalition with Arab nationalist officers, this time the Republican Guards. 13 days after the coup, on July 30th, when the Ba'ath had arranged for one of the key leaders in those in the coalition that might possibly provide competition to the minority Ba'ath group, Daoud, they arranged for Daoud to be abroad, and Bucker invited another potential competitor, Naif, to lunch at the presidential palace. After the meal, Bucker took him to a lounge elsewhere in the building to have tea. Now, I don't recall Adolf Hitler personally being involved in some of these things. The president, and don't anybody think I'm for Hitler, Hitler was the most evil on the stage of history, in modern history, until Saddam came along. But Saddam's worse. And allow his power to grow. What Hitler was able to do is nothing alongside this evil man, left alone, capable of then taking over and controlling more than 80% of the world's energy supply. I mean, Germany was nothing by comparison as a threat. The president then excused himself and left Naif alone in the room. But Bucker never returned. Instead, Saddam Hussein, head of internal security, and an armed companion entered the room. Saddam pulled out his pistol and began to abuse Naif, calling him a son of a whore and other obscenities. Then he pistol-whipped the prime minister on the face. Naif broke down and pleaded that his life be spared. Saddam ridiculed him and bundled him to the airport, shipping him off to Morocco. His civilian associates were swept from the cabinet. Thus ended Naif's 13 days. The Ba'ath were back in power. A decade later, Naif would be killed in London on Saddam's orders. Daoud never returned to Iraq and currently lives in exile in Saudi Arabia. That's Saddam. Saddam put Salah Omar Ali al-Takriti, a member of the party's regional command, in charge of an investigation that began in October 1968. The regime claimed that it had broken up. Now, there are not 5 million Jews in Iraq. We're talking about a media that has lamented the Holocaust. If there were, this is what would happen. He gassed the Kurds. They weren't Arabs. I'm telling you, if there were 5 million blacks, or 5 million Latinos, or 5 million whites in Iraq, he would gas them. His motivations are the same. Where's the media's outcry? There just weren't enough Jews to make it worthwhile to build the ovens, from his view. In October 68, 3 months after taking power, the regime claimed that it had broken up a major Zionist spy ring. In reality, the regime had laid a trap. An agent, Sadiq Jafar, was employed to deliver letters to prominent people in Baghdad and Basra, letters which were written as if addressed to agents of an Israeli spy ring. Soon after Jafar delivered each letter, a security agent would appear and pretend to discover it. Dozens of prominent people were arrested, including former Prime Minister Bazaz, whose death in 1973 would come as a result of his maltreatment in prison. Saddam put Salah Omar Ali al-Takriti, a member of the party's regional command, in charge of the investigation. The experience of one of the accused, Abdul Hadi al-Bachari, a former member of parliament, was typical. When savage torture failed to elicit from him a confession fingering others as spies, as his interrogators demanded, he was threatened with the rape of his wife. He signed the confession and was hanged. The regime also arrested Iraqi Jews. Among the first 14 Iraqis to be publicly hanged, 11 were Jews. The executions on January 27, 1969 were deemed the occasion for a public festival. Some 200,000 people attended the event. Many of them Baghdad workers and peasants from the surrounding countryside, some with their small children in tow. The accused were strung up in rows of gallows in Baghdad's Liberation Square. The proceeding continued for 24 hours. Bakar, Salah Omar, and others made haranguing speeches condemning Zionism and imperialism against the backdrop of bodies dangling from the gallows. And we're there because of oil, manipulated teenagers, out in the streets saying no blood for oil. That's like saying no blood should have been spent to stop the demon of the Holocaust. We're confronting the same thing. Just 4 hours further east on the clock, and several hundred miles further east, with a much greater capacity to strangle the world if he's allowed to go another day. Think about it. And go buy some pies to throw at your TV, like I told you the other night.